It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to the Fox River that underwent one of the largest river contamination cleanups anywhere in the world. We explore the restoration backstory and how it connects to environmental cleanups today. Join in throughout this conversation. Call in with questions. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Susan Campbell was an environmental reporter in this era at the Green Bay Press Gazette, who wrote hundreds of stories about the pollution of the river by Green Bay area paper companies, and is co-author of this new book, Paper Valley, The Fight to Clean Up the Fox River. Susan, welcome to the Ideas Network. Hi, Susan, can you hear us? We're having some trouble hearing Susan. Let's go to Dave Allen is here as well, retired wildlife biologist and environmental consultant. And in the 90s, writing the natural resource damage assessment that brought about the eventual $1.3 billion cleanup. Dave, welcome. Can you hear us?
I sure can. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Well, we're going to pick up Susan here in a moment. Susan, are you there? And we're still going to work on Susan's connection. Dave, let's start with you. You were hired in 1992 by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to contribute to a natural resource damage assessment of this PCB problem in the Fox River in the Bay of Green Bay. What was the history and scope of the problem? Can you bring us up to speed on that?
Sure. Back in the 1950s, a company called NCR invented a new kind of paper called carbonless copy paper. And it was made so that you didn't get that carbon on your hand when you were making, you know, receipts and things and forms in triplicate. And the problem was the stuff that they used to transfer the ink between the layers of that paper was PCBs. And PCBs were originally used for things like transformers and things like that, but it turned out they were also good for some other uses like this. And so NCR started making this kind of paper right on the Fox River at the Appleton plant. And part of the process of making that paper caused some leakage of that coating stuff with the PCBs in it to go out their pipes into the river. And then on top of that, there were a bunch of recycling mills on the Fox River that invented ways to clean up that paper for recycling. So they would put the clean fibers into new paper, but the old the stuff that had the PCBs in it would go right out of their pipes right into the river. So both the manufacturer and the recycling of the PCBs caused the Fox River to get chock full of PCBs in the sediments. By the 70s, the EPA and DNR had required that they stop having any of those discharges from their pipes. But by then, there was all this PCB already in the sediment. So by the 90s, when I got hired by Fish and Wildlife Service, the issue was, what are we going to do about these PCBs that keep coming from the sediments of the Fox River and getting distributed throughout the Bay of Green Bay and into Lake Michigan, where it was causing all kinds of problems? And we were trying to figure out if we could use Superfund or some sort of a voluntary process to try to figure it out. And my agency wanted to use the Superfund process. And so that's where it all started.
And, you know, just explain how lethal PCBs are, how they spread throughout wildlife, and the impact on the environment with this toxic chemical.
Right. So the first thing about PCBs is they're toxic at really, really low levels. So if you have one part of PCBs in 10 trillion parts of water, you've already reached the standards, the water quality standards, to protect human health, aquatic life, and wildlife. So you don't need very much of this PCB to cause a problem. The kinds of problems include, you know, cancer, reproductive effects, hormonal effects. You can get deformities. All sorts of things happen once they get out there. Then on top of that, PCBs were specifically invented so that they would not break down even with high heat and electricity, because they were originally used for transformers. But that also means they don't break down in the environment. So once they get out there, they stick around for decades and decades, probably even centuries. And then the last thing about them is, because the same thing that makes them good for transferring ink in a paper, they like to bind to organic material and they don't like to bind to water. means that they accumulate into organisms. They bioaccumulate every level up the chain, so you get higher and higher concentrations as you get larger and larger organisms. And so they stick around, they bioaccumulate, and it doesn't take very much to cause all of these different kinds of problems.
And those problems just proliferate in the environment. Talking about the pollution and cleanup of PCBs in the Green Bay area with Dave Allen, co-author of the new book, Paper Valley, The Fight for the Fox River Cleanup. You can join in with questions and comments about this work, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dave, throughout your time with Fish and Wildlife in Green Bay, you took these meticulous notes, and you know, you had your notebooks and so many documents about this pollution. Can you explain just why that you couldn't get everyone on board, you know, seeking to bring the court case against the paper mills, the polluters?
Sure. So The first thing I'll say is the reason I took all those notes is we figured when we started this case, we figured that it was probably going to cost at least hundreds of millions of dollars to fix this problem. Mm-hmm. It turned out to cost $1.3 billion. So we were right. It was, you know, it was going to be expensive. And we knew that if we were going to try to get the private sector, the paper companies, those who are responsible for the PCBs, to pay that much money, we were going to have the help of the courts. The courts were going to have to basically say to the paper companies, you actually have to do this, because they weren't going to voluntarily spend that much money on it. And because it was going to go to court, I knew that right at the very beginning that this was going to be a big Superfund case. So I figured that if it ever went to a trial, I would get called as a fact witness because I was right in the middle of the case. And I knew it was going to be very controversial. So I took notes on everything, every meeting, every person, you know, every detail, and kept meticulous records, assuming that I would someday end up in court. Then to the other part of your question, you know, why was it hard to get everybody to go along? Well, a lot of times at Superfund sites, especially if they're not so expensive, if they're only like, you know, $1 million or a few hundred thousand dollars or maybe even $10 million, it's cheap enough that nobody, it's not worth going to court for either side. The court would probably cost, you know, $1 million or $10 million. So you don't want to spend $1 million or $10 million on court if you can fix the site for $100,000 or $1 million. But if once the expense gets high enough, that calculus changes, right? So I think a lot of people at the beginning thought, well, maybe we can get this thing fixed for a few million dollars or a few tens of millions of dollars, and maybe we can do it voluntarily. And I think that difference of opinion about how big the site was really going to be caused some groups and some factions within each group to think, let's do this voluntarily and keep the lawyers out of it. But those of us on the side that thought it was going to be $100 million or $1 billion said, that's just unrealistic. And so we had this very long struggle between factions that thought, let's keep it uncontroversial, not legalistic, and those that said, there's no way to avoid that. And that set up about a 10-year argument, mostly between the state of Wisconsin, who wanted to do it voluntarily, and then Michigan, the feds, and the tribes, who thought this is going to be such a big deal, we'll have to go to court.
At one point, you say that high-stakes Superfund litigation was more like a full contact sport. And there's also the stigma that goes along with saying a place is a Superfund site. What impact do you see there?
Yeah, so, you know, it is like a full contact sport. I mean, you know, if you put $1 billion at stake, if you go to a private company or a set of private companies and say, we want to spend $1 billion of your dollars on something that has nothing to do with your business, that means it's going to be a heated argument. That means you're going to have to actually win cases in court. And so, you know, it is not an easy thing to do. And honestly, the reason I wanted to write this book was I want people to remember that in order to succeed at these very expensive sites, you basically have to go through that controversy and that difficulty to prove your case, even to skeptical people on the other side. And so, you know, I think that's how it turned out. I mean, it ended up, you know, a 10-year administrative struggle between agencies and then another 10 or 15 years of litigation, which the government's won. But you got to do that. And then as to the stigma, it is true that people don't want to be called a Superfund site. So there is a stigma with the label. But it's not really the label which causes the stigma, right? It's the pollution. So you can call it a Superfund site or not, but you still have one of the biggest PCB contamination problems in the country, and that's the real stigma. You've got to do something about that, or you have to live with that stigma.
Paper Valley co-author Dave Allen, retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologist and environmental consultant. Join the conversation at any point on Fox River pollution and restoration. Call in with the question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The authors call it one of the largest, most divisive, and politically charged environmental river cleanups. The over $1 billion fix for widespread chemical contamination of the Fox River. Join in along the way. Call in with questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The book is called Paper Valley, and co-authors Dave Allen and Susan Campbell are here. Susan, in 1993, you and your husband move from Philadelphia to Green Bay to work for the Press Gazette. How did the PCB pollution of the Fox River become a priority subject of your reporting?
Hi, good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
So when we moved to Green Bay, I didn't start out immediately as the environmental reporter because the environmental beat was fallow. They hadn't been covering it for a couple of years anyway. But they decided they saw Dave and his team gathering steam with the natural resource damage assessment, and there'd been a focus group also the summer before that had said they would very much like to see an environmental beat at the Press Gazette, and so. In 1996, the paper invited me to cover the environment, and I was thrilled to do it. And right away, Fox River cleanup became the main focus of my beat. So it was well timed, and definitely the paper had that as their intention, that they wanted to cover that story aggressively.
And your first impressions, I mean, you wrote about how you meet Dave and you thought that U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials might not be a match for the, you know, suit and tie, well-heeled executives at the paper mills. What were those first impressions in responding to this crisis?
Right. My very first meeting, and it had been talked up by the former environmental reporter at the Press Gazette. Had told me, you're going to meet the U.S. Fish and Wildlife official Dave Allen, who's at the crux of this effort. And I was a little intimidated, thinking this is going to be, you know, pretty intimidating guy. And I drove up to the Fish and Wildlife Service building, and I talk about it in the book that it's just the most nondescript building. It looks like an old decrepit post office on the outskirts of town, and I was greeted and ushered inside, and then I met David Allen and one of his colleagues, Ken Stromberg, and I was expecting, you know, I'd been covering courts out in suburban Philly, so I was well versed with covering courts and lawyers, and Dave Allen, it might describe him as he seemed like a Boy Scout. I thought an Eagle Scout.
Dave, you can speak up and defend yourself at any point here.
No, I agree with Susan, and I think it's my favorite passage in the whole book. It's hilarious.
I mean, yeah. Dave, did you feel like a Dave versus Goliath type story going on here, going up against these paper mills and their ally, the DNR?
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, I came from US EPA in Chicago, and so I had a regulatory background already, and I was used to dealing with high-powered executives in companies already. And it is true that I was just a simple field biologist with big round glasses, and I was young and did not look intimidating. But I think that actually worked to my advantage. I think people underestimated not just me, but our whole team. You know, we had a team that was hundreds of people over the whole country, but I was sort of the face of it. And so I was ready for the suit and tie executives, but I don't think I looked the part very much. And it took a while. And honestly, I think that's part of the reason why it took a while for DNR to take us seriously, because they probably figured we weren't really for real the first couple of years.
Let's go further on that. You write that the DNR secretary at the time, George Meyer, opposed the involvement of Oneida Nation tribal authorities in the damage assessment process, was in talks with the paper companies. How would you characterize this reaction from the DNR regarding the prospect of cleaning up the Fox River and the Bay of Green Bay?
Yeah, so, you know, I've thought about that a lot, and I think the guys at DNR, especially in the leadership, were in a terribly difficult position, because it was absolutely 100% clear that the governor did not want Superfund, did not want the federal government, and did not want the tribes involved. So that was crystal clear, right? I think the DNR as an institution very much wanted to do this cleanup and wanted to find the best levers to do it, but I think that they thought that they could handle it on their own. And I think that there was, I mean, I don't want to be unnecessarily harsh, but I think there was a little bit of naivete and a little bit of arrogance in that attitude. I think that they thought it would be easy to handle the feds, the tribes, the paper companies, the public, the lawyers, everybody. And, you know, it's a really good agency, very powerful, very storied agency. And so I think they were used to sort of, you know, getting their way. But they weren't used to $1.3 billion Superfund projects. And so they took some positions early on, as you say. They basically said tribes aren't allowed to do this. They even said the federal government wasn't allowed to do this unless they gave permission. And so this was such an extreme position to take that it actually had the opposite effect. Instead of keeping us at bay, it basically united all of the federal lawyers and managers across the entire government to say, well, we simply can't go along with a position that you can't do a federal or a tribal project in a state without the state's permission. That would violate, you know, constitution and, you know, statutes and regulations and all sorts of things. And so they actually managed to catapult the case into the national limelight by taking those extreme positions.
Dave Allen and Susan Campbell, they're co-authors of Paper Valley, The Fight for the Fox River Cleanup. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Susan, David set up these reading rooms, which I was just fascinated by. They were like government filing cabinets containing thousands of pages of documents related to the PCB contamination. What effect did this have on your reporting, on transparency, and what we can learn today?
The reading room was really quite a feat, and personally, I was fortunate in that I was getting documents sent to me via email, and I was able to download them from the internet because the government was starting to put things on the internet. But the reading room itself was just a marvel, and to have Dave describe it in the book is they were just deluged when they were asking the paper companies for information about the PCBs and the river. They were deluged with information and received box after box after box, and the papers were all kind of in a mishmash and mixed up within the boxes, and Fish and Wildlife, Dave and one of his colleagues there sorted through all of these boxes, hundreds of thousands of documents, and put them in file cabinets and date stamped each one, and had cross-referenced directories that would point you to every single document. And it became a stop for not only the public, but also Dave describes how paper company lawyers.
The paper mills was using the reading room, Dave, along with the public. I just found that really amazing. You know, what did you think about as you put that room together?
Well, so I think there are two critically important aspects of that reading room that I hope people understand, and again, hope people will learn from this and do similar things in the future.
And very quickly here before we go to break. Go ahead.
Okay, good. Number one is it levels the playing field for the public, so they have access to the same information as the more sophisticated defendants, the paper companies. And second, it causes the paper companies to mine that information to turn on each other for the allocation part. So we knew that they would use the reading room to turn on each other, and that's in fact what happened.
Co-authors of Paper Valley, Dave Allen, retired wildlife biologist and journalist Susan Campbell, join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The cleanup of the Fox River, ridding it of toxic PCB pollution, that took years of intergovernmental negotiations, followed by a 17-year cleanup that cost over $1 billion. According to federal regulators, Wisconsin certified completion of the cleanup in early 2023. The book is called Paper Valley. Share your thoughts. Call in with questions, 800-642-1234. Co-authors Dave Allen and Susan Campbell are here. Let's bring on a call, Leah in Milwaukee. Hi, Leah.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I grew up in Kaukauna, Wisconsin, along the banks of the Fox River. My sisters and I caught crayfish in the Fox River. We played in the Fox River as kids. I'm just wondering, what are the longitudinal health impacts of this environmental injustice? You know, my mom is a cancer survivor. My sister suffered from infertility. I wonder if there are related longitudinal health impacts for people who grew up in the 80s and played in the Fox River like I did.
Such an important question. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, so I would say, first of all, swimming is probably not a problem in terms of the PCBs. Now, there may have been other things in the river at the same time that could have been a factor. But for PCBs, you're unlikely to get any major exposure by swimming. The bigger problem is eating the crayfish or fish or anything else from the river. So that's the main route that PCBs get into people is from fishing or waterfowl hunting or, you know, eating crayfish and things like that. There have been some longitudinal studies done, I think, out of Wayne State, looking at various effects in people over several decades, and they did see some correlations of, like, IQ and, you know, brain size and things like that in infants and then later on in life. So, you know, whether that's a strict causation is a little bit hard to tell. That's always the problem with human longitudinal studies. But the main thing I would say is this. There's no amount of PCBs that's good for you, and there's always a risk if you ingest them. So, you know, I myself have fished the Fox River and Green Bay my whole life, and I have eaten some of the fish, and so I worry about that as well. But it's a very difficult thing to pin down exactly how much harm comes to people from ingesting different amounts of PCBs.
Susan, Green Bay Press Gazette, your newspaper, ran editorials suggesting that a costly cleanup would result in area paper mills closing, a lot of people out of work. How worried were people in Green Bay at the time about what was happening?
Quite worried, and up and down the Fox River Valley as well. There were obviously a lot of jobs tied to the paper industry in the Fox Valley and Green Bay, and there had been quite a campaign by paper companies saying that if they were forced to do a cleanup, and especially when that dollar figure started reaching up to $1 billion plus, that the jobs would be lost and paper mills would shutter. And that had been a concern. The paper, obviously, we had Fort Howard in our backyard, and there was concern for paper company jobs and the industry, but also, you know, Green Bay itself was located in the final stretches of the Fox River where it emptied into the bay. And this is where the vast majority, 86% of the PCBs had landed. And mm-hmm. so it was in their backyard. It was in the newspaper's backyard. So they felt a real obligation to talk about the human health impacts of it as well. So
let's bring in Kenneth in Beloit with a question. Kenneth, hi.
How are the PCPs disposed of?
Where did they go, you know, once this was, the dredging was complete? Kenneth, thank you. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, so the PCBs that were dredged out of the river were taken to a special plant that was built for the cleanup right on site, where they dewatered the sediment with big giant presses. They would basically press all the water out of the sediment, and then they would separate out all the sand from the organic material, because the PCBs don't like to stick to sand just like they don't like to stick to water. And that left this very concentrated organic sediment with most of the PCBs in it. And that's what got put into the landfills. And that was put into specially engineered, specially designed landfills near the Fox River. And the responsible parties have continuing responsibility to not only keep those landfills up to spec, but to monitor them closely. So there is some concern always, of course, with, you know, you didn't destroy the PCB, so they are still around the landfills, but it's the smallest volume possible, and it's in the safest possible landfills that can be constructed. So I think we've probably done about as much as we could have done, short of incinerating the sediments, which would have probably made the cost, I don't know, 10 or 20 times higher. So, you know, 10 or 20 billion instead of one.
Chris from Wabino called in and has worked on phosphorus cleanup and thought this was a success story with the amount of PCBs removed. Dave, you know, the paper companies had argued that dredging could stir up and spread the PCBs. How risky is dredging as a form of environmental cleanup?
There are types of dredging that would be risky. So I think the most common kind of dredging that people are used to seeing is navigational dredging. So, you know, digging up the sediment so ships can still go in.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually use great big shovels and just put them on barges. And that would be dangerous, but that's not what the agencies did here. The agencies here use precision hydraulic dredging. So you have an auger, which goes right down to the contaminated spot. You have suction so that the water is going straight into the pipe. We actually have video of the sediment going right into the pipe, and none of it escapes that pipe. And so the type of dredging they used here is extremely safe and was proven to be so through some projects on the Fox River. And then furthermore, they did in some places where the PCBs weren't so high, they used specially engineered caps to prevent anything that was left behind from getting into the fish after the fact.
We're talking about the pollution and cleanup of PCBs in the Green Bay area. Dave Allen and Susan Campbell, co-authors of the new book, Paper Valley. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Jane in Suamico is here. Jane, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, 17 years and $1 billion is huge. And I'm wondering, now that we are aware of the PFAS chemical poisoning, the forever chemical poisoning that's found in 70 different locations and is going into the Bay of Green Bay as well as the Great Lakes, which hold 90% of the fresh water of the United States. I'm wondering, now this is a problem because it's water soluble, where the PCBs are not. Are there any lessons learned that could be translated to the PFAS problem?
Jane, thank you. Dave?
Yes, I think PFAS has got a lot of parallels. There are some differences, of course, as you say, you know, the amount it dissolves in water is one of them. Another one is that they're so ubiquitous. They're everywhere. It's like everywhere you monitor, you find it. And so it's a lot harder to figure out how to fix it. So I would say the biggest lesson from the Fox River PCB cleanup is we have to make sure that the industries that are responsible for the PFAS carry as much of the burden as practical, that we don't want this to just be shifted to the public. And that's what we did at Fox River. I think the same thing can happen to at least some degree on the PFAS issue. Now, again, fixing the PFAS problem, I think, it's a harder thing to do than PCBs, but we clearly have to do something.
Jane, thank you so much for the call. Bob now in Fitchburg. Bob, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yes, I had lived up in the Green Bay area, and I'm an avid fisherman. And I recall, you know, the consumption warnings and such. So we Never really kept any of the fish that we caught and ate any of them. And I'm wondering, now that the cleanup is complete, if they have an idea of how long it would take to cycle through the fish that are in the system right now until we get to a point where they're not contaminated anymore and we could go back to consuming them.
Thank you, Bob. Dave, do you want to field that as well?
Yeah. So right now, the most of the fish are declining in PCBs at a rapid rate, at a quickened rate because of the cleanup. There are still advisories in place on the Fox River, and they're dropping. So I think that, like, so let's say one of the really popular species, walleye. I think for walleye, in one section of the river, you can eat no more than once a month, and in another section, no more than once a week. And what we're hoping for is that soon those will reach, no restrictions at all. And there's a huge monitoring program that's being paid for by the paper companies through the Superfund project to monitor sediments, water, and fish. And so we'll be able to tell when that point is reached. And I think the hope is that we're getting close to unlimited advisories, at least for some species like walleye.
I wonder, Susan, these advisories at the time weren't making it to all people who needed to know and who were fishing the Fox River. What did you find there about communication?
There were a couple of things going on, and one of them was that, yes, the state was and continues to publish fish advisories warning what fish are safe to eat and what shouldn't be eaten and how they should be prepared. But there was a group of subsistence fishermen that were of particular concern, and that was members of the Hmong community. And the concern there was they were ignoring the fish advisories, not because they were scofflaws, but because they couldn't understand the idea of an invisible contaminant that would be contaminating the fish. There was no word in their native Laotian tongue that would describe something like an invisible contaminant. And so they would look at the water and they would say, the water is clean, it's not dirty. And they just didn't believe that this was a hazard to them. And so they would fish daily and bring home fish to their families. And there was another concern too, that contaminants like PCBs are much more of a concern or a heavier body burden on children and developing children in the womb. So the importance of fish advisories and keeping PCBs out of pregnant women and children is especially important. And what the concern was that the vast majority of fishing licenses are purchased by men, and they're the ones, when you receive the fishing license, that's when you would receive the fish advisory. Mm. And so there was a concern that a lot of these fish advisories that were being purchased that were being accompanied with the fishing license were not making it home to the women who were cooking the fish. And then there was one other thing going on where there just weren't enough fish advisories published to keep up with the number of fishing licenses. So there was just not enough of those going around and being
multiple communication issues there. Co-authors of Paper Valley, environmental journalist Susan Campbell and retired wildlife biologist Dave Allen, giving us a lens into the 90s in Green Bay and two decades of cleanup orders and negotiations with paper companies and the intergovernmental negotiations that went on at the same time. Still time to bring up your question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Once one of the nation's largest Superfund cleanup projects, we learn about the massive $1.3 billion removal of PCBs in the Fox River and the inside story of Wisconsin ultimately joining the federal government in the effort, forcing seven paper companies to foot the entire bill for restoration. The book is called Paper Valley. We have co-authors Dave Allen and Susan Campbell. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Paul in Green Bay. Paul, what would you like to share?
Hi, I'd like to say that there are several heroes in this process. And at the top of the list is the Fish and Wildlife Service. The fights between the DNR, Fish and Wildlife Service, the paper mills was huge. I was district director for Congressman Jay Johnson, who was only congressman for 2 years in that time period. Congressman Johnson is no longer with us. May he rest in peace. But I will tell you, Congressman Johnson belongs also at the top of that list. I was at probably every meeting that the congressman had with paper mills who were pressing him to, you know, press the Fish and Wildlife Service and anyone involved in this to lay off, and he would have none of it.
Mm.
We toured the Fox River. We hosted Fish and Wildlife Service. He is deserving of a tremendous amount of credit, because I also know that he lost his race, there was a fair amount of pressure to back off, even though a lot of progress had been made. And I believe to this day that so much progress was made by Fish and Wildlife Service and others that it was too late to turn back after the congressman was defeated.
Paul, thank you for bringing this historical look here. Dave, how did Wisconsin's congressional delegation get involved during these years, decades?
Yeah, so that's another example of being in a difficult position, I think. And I certainly remember Congressman Johnson very well. I remember meeting with him. He was a great supporter. And I remember meeting with the staffers of both Senators Feingold and Cole and others. And they, the difficulty for them was the Fox River Valley is a political stronghold, a very powerful area politically for the entire state. So all the elected officials had to pay attention to what the paper mills were saying. At the same time, you know, they represent the public and they had to listen to the public agencies as well. And I think that at the end of the day, most of the elected officials tried a little bit of intervention, not as much as Governor Thompson, but a little bit. But I think that they very quickly realized that there was enough momentum and enough factual information from, you know, decades of scientific research by people at UWGB and other places that it wasn't practical to stop it. And so I think the elected officials let the agency sort of go forward once Governor Thompson left the state.
Case in point, I think, Susan, from the public's perspective, you write about public comments poured in on Superfund. Over 7,000 residents sent in, you know, during that public comment period about the Fox River. What did you make of that?
Yeah, it was a very divisive issue up and down the river. But there over time, the more information that came out and the more stories that were written about the dangers of PCBs and not only the fish and wildlife, but the people, the more and more people came on the side of wanting this cleanup and actually wanting the river to be designated a Superfund cleanup site, because they felt that it was the only answer to actually getting the river cleaned up. And it, interestingly, you mentioned the public comments. EPA, when they announced that they were going to propose lifting the river for Superfund, they had a 60-day public comment period, and it was really for technical comments. But so many people saw it as a chance to finally be able to weigh in and express their personal opinions that they ended up getting 7,000 comments on postcards. And the majority of them were in favor of the cleanup, although there was certainly a fair representation of people who were against it. But I remember Jim Hahnenberg with EPA saying, you know, these comments are, it was the most, the highest number of comments that EPA had ever received on any proposed Superfund site.
Let's bring in Paul in Delafield now. Paul, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Paul. Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Yeah, my question is, we know that there'll be new chemicals developed all the time. What have we done to anticipate and prepare for the fact that companies will be responsible for the safety, and so we don't get into a situation like this again in the future.
Such a great question, Paul. Thank you, Dave. Go ahead.
The most important aspect of a Superfund site like Fox River is that it proves that the governments can represent the people fairly and win in court. And what this does is it puts everyone on notice in the whole country that if they pollute, they'll be held responsible, or that they can be. And that causes a change in behavior not only for the industries, but for all the real estate agents, all the lawyers, all of the insurance agents. This liability from Superfund, its real power is in teaching that you can be held responsible for the mess you make. And that causes people to try to avoid the mess in the first place. That's the most important thing that we did at Fox River, was to teach the country to pay attention.
Meanwhile, there's the news, Susan. U.S. News and World Report just named Green Bay the best place to live in America. How do you feel about that recognition?
I think it's wonderful. And, you know, I've been up and I've visited. In fact, Dave and I were both up there recently to launch the book. And it's a beautiful transformation that's occurred there. They've spent a lot of money building the city deck there that lines the river, and they've got condos and apartments and restaurants and all this river facing activity and development. And it's really wonderful to see. It's still an industrial working river, but they have made so many strides. So I was really pleased to see that it's getting that recognition. I always thought just the geographic location of it, right there at the mouth of Green Bay, it's really a wonderful place, and I'm glad they're able to maximize that and capitalize on that.
Dave, we have just a few seconds left on your thoughts of this treasure as you, see the Green Bay going forward here.
Well, a great applause for the city of Green Bay, but even closer to my heart is the Bay of Green Bay. I think that we have saved the Bay of Green Bay. It's a jewel of the Great Lakes. It's one of the most beautiful and economically vibrant places in the country. And it's no longer being assailed by PCBs from the Fox River. And so I'm pleased both for the city, but even more for the Bay.
The book is called Paper Valley, The Fight for the Fox River Cleanup. Dave and Susan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dave Allen, retired wildlife biologist, spent 9 years with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, during which he wrote the Natural Resource Damage Assessment regarding harmful PCBs. And Susan Campbell, former environmental reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette and communications manager for the Alliance for the Great Lakes, and now a Milwaukee area real estate agent, Dave, a musician in Marquette, Michigan. And I just want to express some heartfelt thanks to Maria Lopez on her last day here. You know, she brings a show to life and through the control room. Thank you so much. And all the best on WBEZ. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.